This is Whitley Strieber, and this is Dreamland. You've reached the edge of the world. Today we have with us on Dreamland one of the world's certainly premier UFO investigators and one of the most interesting people I have ever had the privilege to know and be friendly with for many years. Leslie Keene, New York Times reporter and author, is with us today to discuss three things. We're going to discuss in the first half hour her book, Surviving Death, A Journalist Investigates Evidence for an Afterlife, and a completely extraordinary take on the whole idea of afterlife. Then some years before, she wrote UFOs, Generals, Pilots, and Government Officials Go on the Record. Where are we now with this? Because Leslie, of course, is a leading exponent of disclosure and a major factor in this field, because she is reporting in the New York Times about this subject as recently as May the 15th, when she reported on hazard reports that had been filed by Navy pilots over the Atlantic. And in the third half hour of the show, we're going to be going into detail about those hazard reports, what they mean, and exactly what is going on. Are these UFOs provably something unknown? I wouldn't say provably aliens from another planet, because I already know how her I shall answer that the same way I would. But are they provably unknown? That we'll find out. Leslie Keene, welcome to Dreamland.
Whitley, it's a pleasure to be here with you. Thank you for having me on.
Well, it's always a great pleasure to talk. And now we're talking on the air instead of just shooting the breeze on the phone, which is much more our usual modus operandi.
I know, but that's also fun. Both of them are fun.
Right. So. I have great friendships with many people in the field, and we talk a lot on the phone, and we ought to all get together on a Zoom conversation one of these days. But I hasten to add, for various reasons, that would be terribly complicated. Right, Leslie?
Yeah, I can imagine. I can imagine.
Yeah. Okay. Now let's go back to Surviving Death. In 2015, after Annie died, she came back, as you know, and I wrote a book called The Afterlife Revolution. At the same time, you were beginning to work on Surviving Death. And what was it that drew you to the subject in the first place?
Well, and I actually started on it in around 2013. And Whitley, I've just had a curiosity or question or, you know, interest in this really for a long, long time. And even though I spent all those years before my UFO book came out, which was in 2010, I spent all those 10 years investigating UFOs and reporting on UFOs, I, in the background, was also sort of poking around a little bit into the question of the afterlife or of just the nature of consciousness and whether it survives death. And so I was particularly drawn to the stories of children that have memories of reincarnation, because they're just young children, and that was very evidential to me. And I actually went to visit a family in Scotland with somebody who was making a film about this and got to meet the family and the child. So I was, you know, very stimulated about it. And then after, when my book came out on UFOs, there was a couple of years of, there was a special that I did for the History Channel and a bunch of stuff that happened. And then after that, this just seemed like the natural topic for me to jump into. My publisher asked me if I wanted to do another book, and it was quite a synchronicity, because literally the same week that my publisher asked me that, I was planning to propose it to them, and I'd actually written up a proposal that I do a book on this topic. So it was a perfect synchronicity. The other thing that happened was I was with my friend Bud Hopkins at the moment that he died. And that was a really profound experience for me, Whitley, because I'd never been present for a death like that. And he was in hospice, so there was a long process of dying and the moment, and it was just extremely surreal and just a lot. It affected me very profoundly to witness that, and I think it helped stimulate my desire to kind of understand even more what is going on here. You know, is this person just this dead body, or is there something else that's going
something
on with
else.
This? And yeah, so I just, it was sort of a thing, you know, a lot of factors came together. And the thing about the book Surviving Death that makes it different than UFOs, it's a different topic, but it really was a subject that I explored as I went along during the process of writing it. I didn't know where it was going to go. It was a journey that I took, whereas my book on UFOs was an accumulation of 10 years of investigation.
Right.
You know, I already collected it. I kind of knew what I needed for it. But this book was a way more open-ended process.
Free Dreamlanders, listen up. We'll be right back.
This is Whitley Strieber. This is a Dreamland special event. In a few moments, you're going to be hearing an extraordinary interview. Linda Howell is interviewing Gary McKinnon. Gary McKinnon is about to be extradited in all probability to the United States to face charges for allegedly hacking into U.S. Defense Department and NASA computer systems in search of UFO information. Mr. McKinnon is a British citizen and has been fighting extradition, preferring to be tried in courts in his own country.
There follows a truly extraordinary interview between Linda Moulton Howe and Gary McKinnon, one of the few. Gary McKinnon was the young Britisher who hacked into NASA's computer system and found all kinds of very unusual material about space forces and all sorts of things. Well, now in 2020, the Space Force is going public. So was it really there all along? One of the few places you can hear an interview like this is on unknowncountry.com. This is one of the most extraordinary places in the world, and you really should get into it. Subscribe to unknowncountry.com today. You can listen to Gary McKinnon speaking very frankly about what he found, and there is so much more on this website. It is literally a treasure trove. Go to unknowncountry.com right now, click on the subscribe tab, and get started. There is real wonder waiting for you.
In 2015, Whitley Strieber entered a whole new level of contact, and his new book, A New World, tells the powerful and revealing story of what's been happening. Read about contact experiences unlike you have ever heard described before. Learn about the breakthroughs in communication that are developing right now. Experience the wonder of seeing into a mirror universe. The thrill of discovering the close encounter experience in an entirely new way. And learn the secret of how Whitley has built a very real and ongoing relationship with our otherworldly visitors. One Amazon reviewer says, a significant document of human empowerment. Another, one mind-bending, reality-shifting read. Another, outstanding. Get A New World today, available as a paperback, a hardcover, and an ebook wherever books are sold, and as an audiobook read by Whitley on audible.com.
We're talking to Leslie Kane. Leslie's website is leslycane.com. Leslie's website is survivingdeathkane.com. That's survivingdeathkane.com. We're talking about her book, Surviving Death, right now. In a little while, we're going to go on to UFOs, generals, pilots, and government officials go on the record. And where is that now? What is happening now? Because the book's been out for a while, but a lot has happened. Then in the third half hour, we're going to be talking about her May 15th New York Times story about those Navy pilot hazard reports that were filed about unknown objects over the Atlantic, what they mean, and what is actually maybe going on behind the scenes. Leslie, when we left the air, you were talking about the moment of Bud's passing, and it's an extremely profound moment. I, of course, know that. I've been present with, at my age, with more than one, and the most extraordinary one being my wife's, when she said in my mind, just before she died, she said, Whitty, I'm dying right now. And I rushed into the bedroom, put my hand on her heart, and it beat its last under my hand. So wow. What was it like with Bud?
That's a profound story, Whitley. I mean, with Bud, I was just holding his hand. I wasn't touching his heart, but it was like the breath. You'd see the breath get slower and slower. And then nothing changed, except suddenly there was no more breath. And that was the only noticeable difference between before the death and after the death. And you just sit there for a while and he didn't breathe again. And that's what it was. And it was just, it's just hard to comprehend how somebody can be present in one moment and then gone the next.
Yes, it is.
I mean, you know, it's very hard to describe to somebody who hasn't experienced it, but it has a very surreal quality to it. You're just sort of beyond the grief side of it, and I'm not talking about that side. I'm talking more of a sense of being sort of awestruck that this happens and the mystery of it, you know, what is really going on here? That's the part that really touched me very deeply. But it's hard to put it into words.
And did you have any sense ever after Bud passed on that he was still in some way here or aware of us?
I did, Whitley, because I had some readings with some mediums, some very, very good mental mediums. And I wrote about these two readings in my book, actually, in which it seemed that Bud was right there coming through with a lot of information. And his personality was there, you know, endless details about his life and our relationship and things. There were some things he said that only I would have known. There was one thing in particular. And it was just phenomenal to me. So I did feel that he was there in those, at those moments. And my brother had also passed away in January of 2013. He came through the readings as well. And what was interesting was his personality was the exact opposite of Bud's. And all, and you could feel that in the reading, the way they handled themselves, their style, the way they asserted themselves or didn't assert themselves, all of those things were exactly the way they were in their personalities, which were very different. So that kind of heightened the reality of it for me. And it was a very, very incredible experience because I'd never had anything like that before, and I didn't know what would happen when I sat down with the medium. I had no idea whether anything would come through.
And
then I was just blown away. Yeah.
I've never had much success personally with mediums. I wonder, I have to ask, because I know the listeners are curious. I'm curious, too. Did he ever say anything about his UFO work or his abduction work?
I mean, he didn't give a lot of, insight that we didn't already know, but that came up as a means of the medium identifying who he was. So, you know, and I think, Whitley, you probably don't need a medium. That's why they haven't worked for you.
I don't.
You don't need one.
You know how I knew Bud was dead? I was meditating, and it turned out to be that night or the night after that the night he died or the night after. And I was meditating, and suddenly there was Bud, and he was laughing at me, and he was in a car, and he was leaving. Mm-hmm. And
wow.
I thought, Bud died. I knew he was ill, of course.
I think you might have told me that before.
Yeah, really, I may have told you that. It's like when Carl Sagan died, I had no idea he was even ill. And as I was waking up one morning, there he was standing in the bedroom, and he screamed at me, like that.
No.
And then he was gone. And I said to Ann, Carl Sagan died. So that happens a lot to me. It's nothing unusual.
Yeah. And you're your own medium.
I guess so, but I can't do it. You know, I can't channel like they can. I'm so jealous.
Well, they do it for other people. I mean, you have your role to play. You've got something else that you're doing. You know, I wouldn't be jealous. You have extraordinary things going on.
Well, so do you. Let's go on. Let's circle back to the book because one of the things that seems to have happened, and you can see it as you read into the book, that you are literally discovering. You can feel that sense of discovery in the book. And at what point did you realize that you were really onto something? That this was perhaps bigger than you thought when you started writing it?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, I started off with the child reincarnation cases, which to me are incredible, but they're not personal. You know, there's not. So in terms of research,
well, tell us a little bit about them.
Well, they basically involve cases of very, very young children, let's say between two and three as a sort of standard, you know, and there's variations, of course, but these children will remember very, very specific details, which they say are from a past life. They'll often have nightmares related to how they died in the past life. They'll have behaviors and knowledge related to skills that they had in their past life, which they couldn't possibly have now. The parents are aware of everything their child's been exposed to at that age. So there's a whole lot of things that happen. And then when eventually an investigator is able to find out, based on what the child has said, that person that he says he was actually lived, and they're able to identify who that person was, find that person's family, and basically verify that everything the child said about that person is accurate. And that, you know, is very, very strong evidence for the reality of reincarnation or rebirth. And I have two cases in my book that are about American children. It's not just children in Asia, you know, which is where many cases are because the culture supports it. But these two cases are really, really strong, and these children remembered a lot. And so I found, you know, as a journalist looking at research, this was incredible evidence, and it was really powerful. But as I went through the process of researching this book, it was the personal experiences are the things that really, as you said, pointed out, you know, really make a shift in you and make you start to realize that something really is going on here that's much bigger than you thought, because you start to experience it for yourself. That changes it. It's not just research. And so I integrated my own personal experiences into the book, which is, you know, maybe two-thirds research and one-third my own experiences. And so that's, you know, and it was a gradual unfolding. The first things that happened to me that were personal were these two readings that I had with these mediums that were, you know, way more accurate than your average reading is. I mean, I've talked to people who study mediums, and these were like almost unheard of in their accuracy. And I made sure that these mediums did not know anything about me in advance. I didn't even use my name. You know, I made sure I didn't use my email address when I contacted them. So they
were
not.
How did you choose the mediums, and can you tell us who they were?
Yeah, definitely. The first one's name was Laura Lynn Jackson. She's quite well known, and I found her through an organization called the Forever Family Foundation, which is this wonderful, it's a married couple who started it years ago, all volunteer organization, which basically studies mediums. It certifies them. They have a process through which they test mediums to certify them. And it tries to make people aware of the role that mediumship can play in grief, that it can really help people in their grief process. And so I contacted those people, and they recommended Laura Lynn Jackson to me. And she was the first reading I did that blew my mind. Now, she has since become very famous and written her own books. I was lucky to get a reading with her, because now you have to wait like 5 years and you can't even get on her list, and she charges a lot of money. It's changed. So people can look her up. She's a very, very good medium. And then the second one was a woman named Sandra O'Hara, who is in Ireland, and she's very accessible. She does her readings over Skype, and she was the one, you know, I was so sure with her that she didn't know anything about me. And it was just, the interesting thing was, really, just to tell a very quick story, after I did the reading with Laura, which was the first one, I meditated and asked my two people, which was Bud and my brother, to come through the second time with the second medium, whose name was Sandra, and to please repeat something that they said the first time to me. Because I said, then I'll really know it's you. I just want you to repeat something that you said before. And I hadn't, you know, of course, I didn't think it would ever work. I just thought, what the hell, I'm going to try this. And I would meditate and ask them this. And when I did the second reading, that's exactly what happened. I was really stunned. And both of them said the thing that was the most personal the most personal thing from Laura's reading was what they repeated in the second reading. So it was something
Wow.
that couldn't possibly be found anywhere. It was known only to me. So I thought that was a pretty amazing confirmation of the power of mental mediumship and the, you know, the reality.
What were they doing, do you think? Do you think they were accessing your mind or accessing something else?
Well, that is the big debate about mental mediumship, is the whole question of what they call living agent psi or super psi or whatever. The question is, does the mental medium use her own powers, which would be telepathy and clairvoyance, to bring that information through, or does she actually access the spirits of the dead people? And of course, the medium is 100% sure that she is in touch with those spirit people. So we have to give a lot of credit to what the medium experiences in her work. But the problem is there's absolutely no way to prove it either way. But this is a debate that goes on among people who study the scholarly philosophers and people who write and study about this, that there really isn't a way to prove it. But when you're sitting there in that reading and you feel your loved one's personality and attitude and, you know, this very specific personal information that's coming through, it feels definitely like they're there. But as I said, it's not something provable.
Not provable in we've evolved in the past 200 years a definition of proof that is very different from what we had before, and it's a better definition of proof, don't get me wrong, because it requires significant amounts of substantiation, but at the same time something is lost too, in that when you're dealing with something like this, a non-local mind, as you put it in the book, it is living and experiencing by a different criteria. Like if they're outside of time looking in, it must be a very different vision of reality than we have. Now, that said, before you reply, we have come up on another break. And so, Free Dreamlanders, listen up. We'll be right back.
The new unknown country is becoming a social hotspot for people interested in UFOs, ETs, the contact phenomenon, and so much more. Becoming a site user is free and enables you to participate in our active free message boards. And if you join as a paid subscriber, you'll also gain access to our weekly subscriber chats and video meetings, plus access to our podcast archives, meditations, video section, and so much more. So join free or subscribe. Either way, unknowncountry.com belongs in your life.
All of my summer conferences have been canceled except one, Consciousness and Contact, the last weekend in July on the Pine Ridge Lakota Sioux Reservation in South Dakota, the site of the extraordinary experience I had last summer that I describe in A New World of Seeing into a Parallel Universe. We'll be back. We're going to do a CE5 experiment at the Devil's Tower. That's attempting to call and get into contact with the visitors as a group. Linda Moulton Howe is going to be there, Barbara Lamb, and many others. It's going to, without question, be an extraordinary conference. But there's a kicker. The kicker is there are only 35 guests. We have 10 speakers and 35 attendees. That is it. So if you want to go, go to unknowncountry.com right now and click on the Consciousness and Contact ad, or email mia.ferroleto@gmail.com. That's Mia, M-I-A, dot Ferroleto, F-E-R-O-L-E-T-O, @gmail.com to find out more. We're talking to Leslie Kane. Surviving Death is what we're talking about right now. Her website is Surviving Death Kane, that's SurvivingDeathKEAN.com. In a little while, we're going to be talking about UFOs, generals, pilots, and government officials, probably to the leading expert on this field on this planet, and maybe on others too, for all we know. Then later, we're going to be talking to her about the story that appeared in the New York Times on May the 15th, Navy reports describe encounters with unexplained flying objects. What were these hazard reports, and what is their significance? So we got a lot to cover. Leslie, let's keep going, and I want to talk a little bit about your perception of what consciousness is, in the sense that I've lost a lot of my assumptions that my consciousness is contained in my body. My body is contained in consciousness, and there's a big difference. But what are these entities that are coming to you? Like, what was Bud like? You say you felt his personality. Do you think if you went to a medium that Bud would return as he was then, or do they change?
That's a good question. Yeah. I mean, I've gone to some other mediums since those two, and I have not had anything close to that kind of success. I find in general with people who go to mediums that, you know, the magic tends to happen closer to when the person passes than it does like many years later. Maybe the person in spirit moves on to some other realm or something, or they get focused on something else and they're not as accessible to us here. But Whitley, believe me, I have no idea. I'm just speculating here. And these readings were a few years after he died. So I don't know. I was very, very connected myself. And I think a reading is a combination of three. It's the sitter, the medium, and the person being contacted. And all three of those energies have to combine in the right way to make it happen. So I was very focused on it as well. And I think that might have had a lot to do with why it was so successful. So I don't know if that answers your question, but the personality.
Well, I know it talks to the question, but I don't expect a definitive answer to a question like that.
Yeah, it feels incredible in the moment. And I certainly, in the moment, allowed myself to experience this as if they were present, because that's what it felt like to me. And I taped the readings, and I knew that later I could analyze them and be a journalist and do anything I wanted to see if they were accurate and speculate and step back and be more objective. But in the moment, it was an absolutely mind-expanding experience. I mean, after the first reading, I didn't sleep that night. It can be life-changing, and it was for me. And as for what it says about consciousness, I mean, I think the main thing that my book does, because we can't ever prove survival, although you probably have in your relationship with Anne, but
Anne and I work together every day, so it's not
exactly so. And you're the one that should be talking about it,
right? There's a physical element to it too. It's not right. all mental at all. There's a very physical element to it. I'm not willing to talk about it, but it is there. So when I say I'm not willing to talk about it, there are reasons having to do with the energy of it that I think I understand that if I bring it out too much, it makes it harder for her. So,
That's interesting.
We work together all the time.
So you have that proof. And I was as a journalist kind of, you know, trying to do, I did a lot of research, which is very compelling, but also, you know, I was tasting this for the first time. But certainly, I think the book does really show that consciousness is absolutely functioning independently of our bodies. I think that, as far as I'm concerned, that's been proven. I mean, it really has in so many different ways. Whether we can take that a step further and say, therefore, if consciousness can be separate from the brain, therefore it survives death, that's a very logical assumption to make and a very likely one. This is where my book ends up. I mean, your situation is completely different than mine, but as far as my situation was concerned, that's sort of where it goes, you know.
Yeah, but yours is more so validating in a way because, you know, I'm after all, mine is personal experience, but you're reporting.
Right. I'm reporting, and I am, and I include personal experiences, which I think adds to it, but I'm also objective about those experiences. So I think everything I bring together, because I draw from areas of research from a lot of different ones, and I show how they all kind of point to the same thing. And it basically is that consciousness is not a function of cells in our brain. You know, it's something way bigger than that. And it's independent of the physical body. And there are many, many ways that we can see it operating. in that way. And there are a lot of mysterious things that happen in the physical world as a result of this this consciousness that we can't explain. So right. We don't know really what it is.
Well, the beauty of your book is it's very empowering in that it is by a reporter, and it contains a lot of stories, not personal narrative, but stories like this. Lloyd Auerbach story is a perfect example that just comes to mind because it struck me so powerfully. Why don't we talk, instead of talking about that particular story, what it is, folks, is Lloyd Auerbach, had a friend, the author Martin Caden, and there was a very extraordinary reappearance of Martin Caden in Lloyd Auerbach's life. Now, that said, I would like you to, if you could, to tell us one of the stories that struck you as particularly powerful. It could be this one. I don't know what it would be. But in the book, not of your own experience, but of the experiences of others that you researched and are reporting on.
Wow, that is a big question because there were many. I think you brought up Lloyd Auerbach. I mean, I think his story about the interactive apparition, do you remember that one? Who actually, I find the question of interactive, I just find that to be really fascinating. And one thing that I did in my book, just so people know, is that I invited other people to write some chapters themselves, just like right. I did with UFOs. So in Lloyd's chapter, he describes a case of a family. It was an 11-year-old boy and the two parents who lived together, and they were all seeing this ghost form in the house who would wave to them. I mean, it was literally responding, and they all saw it at different times and didn't tell each other about it until they finally did, but they had all seen it independently, and it turned out that this spirit learned how to communicate to the child who was 11. He was sort of like a medium. He could get all this information from this apparition. And she became like a friend of his, and he would talk to her every day. And what happened was that she provided information to him about her life. And they were finally, this was years later, they were able to find a cousin of the woman, because I think she had died in that house. And they took him a long time, but they found a relative of hers who was able to verify that everything she had told the boy about her life was accurate. So it was kind of an interesting story because it points to the reality of what we call ghosts or apparitions.
Right.
And it's also sort of like mediumship in a way, that this child just had this natural ability to get information from this. It sort of verifies mediumship in a way, if you know what I'm saying, because this child was getting information from this spirit person, but it was a spirit person that could be seen. So it kind of verifies the fact that when a medium does that, maybe it really is a spirit person, because this time we know it was.
Well,
so,
you know,
it's really interesting.
You're talking to someone who's actually seen a dead person materialize physically and held his hand. So, you know, I am convinced that there is a reality here. And that, by the way, I understand how that's done, and the amount of concentration is awesome. You have to have a very powerful attention, a developed attention, in order to do that, and it has to be developed in this life. If you die without it, you can't do it. And this particular individual is extraordinary. He's an angelic master, would be the best way to describe him. And he travels with a group of six others, and they're all remarkable people. I've known them since 1997, I think. Anyway.
Wow. So did you know them when they were physical before
No. They showed up at the old cabin banging on the roof with a great furor one night and began meditating with me. That's in my books. It's in Supernatural, and I think it's in Solving the Communion Enigma, and referred to briefly in A New World. So I'm not going to go into the story. My listeners all know it. But suffice to say that there is much more there than we realize and that we allow ourselves to believe. I suspect that the dead walk among us from time to time, and I don't think we know it, and I don't think we're meant to. Okay.
Right.
Here we go.
Well, that's fascinating, Whitley. You know a lot of stuff firsthand. I mean, I had some experiences with materializations when I was with physical medium Stuart Alexander, which I get to at the end of my book.
Yeah.
But it's not the same situation with you where it was sort of spontaneous. It was in a very controlled, you know, ritualistic kind of setting. But I have experienced that myself, and it's
mind-blowing. You know, I have to learn how to become a disciplined medium. I'm going to look into how to do that.
I don't think you...
I have so much contact with the dead at this point in my life.
Wow.
It's just I have to figure out how to do that, and the only way to do that is to find somebody who can teach me and give me the confidence to do it, because my mind, I always feel like my own head will interfere. Now,
I have something I can send you that I think might help you with that, Willie.
Oh, good.
I'll
good.
Talk about it after.
Yeah, please do. That would be wonderful.
Yep.
Okay. And now we go on down the road to a different field entirely, or is it so different? I'll never forget Annie's saying that the close encounter experience had something to do with what we call the dead, which annoyed Bud very much, but I think was on the money.
Well, if he were around now, he might agree with it.
Well, yeah, now that he's where he is, he probably does agree with it.
But, right now, yeah. But, I mean, even if he were still alive,
yeah,
he probably would have evolved and understood more.
Probably so. I mean, Bud was had a very vital mind, and he was a good man in many, many respects. So, any case, UFOs, generals, pilots, and government officials go on the record. Let's go back to the time that you decided to write this. Here you are, working as a reporter, and suddenly you decide to report on the most taboo, scorned, and dismissed subject on the planet. What in the world drove you to this seemingly insane conclusion?
I know it was, and I thought it was insane. You're talking back when I first started the whole process, right?
Right.
The first time it was in 1999, and it was really felt insane, Whitley, and it's funny to think back on it because I think times really have changed a lot, but it was when I received in the mail from a friend in France, a colleague, this Cometa report, which probably your listeners have heard about, but I can, you know, it's just to be brief, it was a report written by French generals, by three or four generals, an admiral, a police chief, some engineers, some scientists. They're very, very outstanding French people, objective people at high levels who studied this phenomenon for 3 years and only looked at official cases and did this, you know, 99-page report on it. And they presented all this case data, and then they came to this conclusion, which said that the extraterrestrial hypothesis was the most valid, logical, and rational way to explain the data that they had acquired over this three-year investigation. And they sort of explained why it wasn't this, why it wasn't that, and therefore this is what we're left with. And I just got this as a journalist. I was just a regular journalist working at a public radio station doing investigative news shows. And suddenly this thing lands on my desk, and I'm thinking, like, this has got to be the biggest story ever. You know, you have generals saying that we are very likely, and it's a, you know, very likely being visited by extraterrestrial craft. And it just really hit me over the head because I thought, what if American generals said that? What if American generals put this report out? What would the reaction be? So I thought I had an absolutely huge story. I was able to get the story into the Boston Globe because I'd written for the Globe before, and it was in the spring of 2000. It finally came out, this long story based on that report, and that's how I got started. But I'll tell you, Willie, that editor was so nervous about publishing this story. It was like at one point she canceled the whole thing and she was like editing it to death. And it was just, and I was also hiding in the halls of the radio station where I worked, not wanting anybody to know that I was even doing this. That's how bad it was. The taboo. Yeah, even among progressive people at this radio station, I tried testing the waters a little bit, and no, they were like, it was to them a complete jerk. You know, it was just a joke. And so I didn't want to even talk about it. And it was only when it came out on the Boston Globe that they were willing, able to sit back and say, well, maybe there really is something to this. So that's how it all got started. And I gradually learned about you know, the taboo, and I just went through a whole journey with it. But yeah, it really was, I felt it was a real risk for me to do it. I felt like I was risking my career, but it didn't turn out to be that way. I mean, definitely didn't turn out to be that way, because I then started doing nothing else but this. And I eventually left the radio station and was managed to be able to do UFOs full time, and then did a lot more with it. But that's how it got started.
Which is it's a very gradual process that's happening, but it is happening. Now, in my case, it's a different story, because for the abduction community, there has been essentially no progress. In fact, it's retrograde in the sense that the more the general public, and in particular the media and publishers and so forth, come to realize that there's something here that we can't explain, the more hostile they become to the abductees, is in my experience. Because, for example, there was a time when anyone would publish my books and would want my books. I couldn't sell A New World to any publisher. And there's been some interest in Communion as a movie lately, another or something anyway in the media. And when I talked to HarperCollins about it, they don't want to do anything with Communion. They haven't made an ebook of it. There's no audio book to speak of, just an old abridged version. And they don't want to do anything with it. They actively would like to see it just die.
Now, that's, I'm really surprised. I'm so surprised to hear that.
It's very different.
It should be the opposite. It should be that as time goes on, you know, more and more is learned about it and more respect is gained, because
it's
there's
fear.
More that we know.
It's fear.
Maybe that's right.
Oh, yeah. Now, the interesting, let's talk about some of the things the Cometa Report was. What was its origin, by the way? How did it get started?
Well, there was a military think tank in a military institute in France, where these military people would go after they retired, and they would, I don't know exactly what they did there. They were consultants for the government. You know, they were still very involved with the military, but they were retired. And I think there was one general in particular who just had an interest in this topic. His name was General Dennis Leti, who was one of the originators of the report. And he had, I think a number of them had pilots over their careers, had known pilots who had sightings. And for whatever reason, they had a personal interest in it. And they managed to bring together the rest of the group. And it was an independent study. It was not a government study. But when they finished it, they sent it to the government in France. They was sort of like a white paper that they sent around to high levels within France. And what they were calling for was that pilots needed to be trained on how to deal with UFOs when they encountered them.
Yeah, because, well, in the third half hour, we're going to find out that's true. Go ahead.
Exactly. Well, their argument was that there's a risk that if pilots see something, and if it's close to their aircraft and it's something they don't know anything about, there might be an accident just due to their reactivity. They might react in fear or make some kind of sudden movement, or, you know, do something because they're startled by it. But if they're trained, then they will be taught how they should behave when such a thing occurs, and they won't be taken back by it. So that was their argument, that it was just a matter of time before there was going to be an accident, and that it would be caused by human error. It wouldn't be caused by the UFO or by any aggression. So they were concerned sort of about the national security and aviation safety elements of the issue. That's sort of what motivated them to do it. And that made it even more compelling, because it was a paper that would appeal to government agencies who were concerned about that, and it would give them a reason to care about it. You know, they need some reason. They need an umbrella to put it in, so that they can justify why they would even be concerned about it. And the safety issue is one that always serves that purpose.
I'd like to get a little bit into the long history of secrecy and hostility toward this whole subject. And to do that, I thought it would be most valuable to go back to the year 1977, when Frank Press, this is a year and a half after Carter was in the White House, and Carter, who had famously said that he would get to the bottom of the UFOs when he was in the White House. Now, what happened when Frank Press wrote to NASA suggesting a panel of inquiry to see if there were significant findings since the Condon report? Because you and I both know the Condon report was a complete whitewash. There were significant findings before and after, and in 1977, there was an enormous record present of all kinds of sightings, and far beyond that, in a whole very large number of areas. Now, what happened that they didn't? What happened to the effort the Carter administration made?
Well, I remember studying this, and I have actually all the documents from the communications, and I'd have to refresh my memory a little bit, but Frank Press, as you mentioned, who was the science advisor to Carter, wrote to the NASA administrator on behalf of the president and recommended that they set up what they called a panel of inquiry to try to find out if there were any new significant findings since the Condon report. That's what they were asking for. And they just thought that NASA would be the place, which should be the place where such an office would be set up. And it was very clear that the president was behind it. And he had made an argument for why it should happen. And there were a lot of communications back and forth. And then eventually the upshot of the whole thing was that NASA said no. They said to the president of the United States, "We understand that you want us to do this, and we're not going to do it." That was the upshot of it. I've got something in front of me here right now that says that the reason they turned him down, or at least in their what they said their reason was, that, and here's actually a quote from the letter, if you'd like me to read that, from the NASA. The NASA official who wrote this letter said that they needed bona fide physical evidence from credible sources, tangible or physical evidence available for thorough laboratory analysis in order to set this thing up. And since they didn't have such evidence, they said, quotes, "We have not been able to devise a sound scientific procedure for investigating these phenomena." So that's why they wouldn't do it. And I think to me what's a little silly about that is if they'd set it up, then perhaps they would have obtained the physical evidence because they would have had high clearances, assumedly, and they would have maybe been able to obtain it and then study it. The fact that they didn't have it already didn't really make any sense to me. But that was what they told the president. I thought that was quite shocking.
Yeah, absolutely. Because here's the thing. There are so many layers to this. Do the people who said that to the president, do you suppose they had any idea of anything that was actually going on? Because, well, for example, my uncle back in 1947 and General Arthur Exon began a program of studying the debris from Roswell that, according to General Exon, was still very much underway in the 1980s. And he had been directly involved in it until the 1960s with a large group of scientists. So it's fantastic that it would be so layered and so hidden and so extensive. It just beggars the imagination.
It does. I mean, my sense of it from talking to a physicist named Richard Henry, who was a prominent astrophysicist, he's now at Johns Hopkins University. He's very interested in this topic, and he was at NASA at the time. My sense of it from him was it was just something that they did not want to take on because of the stigma against UFOs, and they just didn't want to go there. And they were trying to find a way out of it. And that was about it. I don't think they probably were consciously had information that they were trying to cover up, but they were sort of part of that whole, consciousness that was prevalent at the time of, the Condon Committee had done its thing, and nobody official wanted to get involved with this. And this is just an example of that, I think. But even the president couldn't change it.
Yeah, and he, in fact, when Stanton Friedman asked him point blank at a book signing, he stood in line and got a book autographed and asked him point blank, what happened? Why did he go silent? He refused to talk about it. as if someone had told him, you know, you must not pursue this. You must not talk about it.
Or maybe he just didn't want to because he didn't want to be barraged by UFO people. Who knows? Yeah. I mean, sometimes people clam up because so many people in the UFO community will go after somebody once they say something. And that can have a negative effect, actually.
The foreword to your book was written by John Podesta. And the last thing he said as the Obama administration was winding down was his greatest regret was that he had not been able to convince Barack Obama to release the UFO files.
Yeah, or convince, was it Obama? Like Obama was in a position to do it? I don't know.
Or I don't know.
Did he just say that they weren't released, period?
Maybe I'm wrong about that.
I think he said something like to get them released. Yeah, he wasn't able to do it.
But that implies he knows something about them, that they exist. In fact, we know now that they do.
And I don't think he would doubt they exist, but I don't think, having talked to him over the years, I don't think he has a lot of inside knowledge of, you know, things that he's keeping secret or anything. He wants it all to come out.
Right.
And he's been a tremendous voice in Washington, you know, standing behind the belief that the public has a right to this information.
He knows it's there, but he doesn't know what it is. Listen, Leslie, we're having such a great discussion. I have to stop for the Free Dreamlanders, and I wish I didn't Free Dreamlanders. And one of the ways to prevent that is for you to finally subscribe. There are thousands and thousands of you, and you don't subscribe to the site, and so we have to go on doing this. But in any case, here are some commercials for you. Please, if you don't subscribe, do something else that they suggest you do. We'll be right back.
Owls are somehow connected to UFOs. I don't say that lightly. After over a decade of obsessive investigation, I am convinced of this connection. As strange as it may seem, people are seeing owls in the highly charged moments of a UFO sighting, and within the challenging memories of UFO abduction. This mystery has been the focus of my research. My name is Mike Cleland, and I have explored these connections in my book, The Messengers. At its core, this book is simply a collection of stories, and each is a remarkable real-life experience. The Messengers is also my own story of how owls played a role in my life. It's an exploration into the deeply personal questions that arose from my own contact experiences. The Messengers is the first in a trilogy of books, and each volume explores a deeper aspect of the UFO mystery. All my books are available on Amazon in paperback, ebook, and very soon as audiobooks.
This is just a quick reminder that the unknowncountry.com store is now open. You can enter it by going to unknowncountry.com and clicking on the store tab. You'll find all of my available books and much more.
A new world is coming. Whitley has just finished his book about what it's like to live with and communicate with the visitors. A new world, unforgettable.
We're talking to Leslie Kane. Her website, Surviving Death Kane, that's KEAN.com. Her book, Surviving Death, A Journalist Investigates Evidence for an Afterlife, and UFOs, Generals, Pilots, and Government Officials Go on the Record. Still, in both cases, among the best books ever written in either field. Now, there seems to be, Leslie, two parallel worlds here inside the government. We all talk about insiders and people who know things, and we know they exist. I know you'd love, as a New York Times reporter, to find some of them and talk to them. But they are very elusive. Now, every once in a while, something comes along that suggests that there's a much bigger world. They're like General Exon's discussion with me, and like, quite frankly, what happened in the Carter administration, because a door was being closed. It wasn't being said that there's nothing behind the door. It's being said, better not open it. Now, as we you moved forward in the book, what you would you say that there might be somewhere in here a national security issue that's very significant that they don't want to address directly? For example, because maybe the abductions are real and they can't be stopped. Do you have any sense of anything like that?
Yeah, I mean, I never have come up against the abduction issue, just I think maybe partly because I've been so focused on sort of hard evidence and physical evidence and government documents and military people and things like that. And I mean, I would love to know more about what they, in quotes, whoever they are, actually know about abductions and what they're doing about it. I have no idea, Whitley. I assume you probably know more about that than I do, you know, given you've been focused on it for so long. I've certainly run up against secret programs that have other kinds of information in them that are absolutely impenetrable.
Can you, talk about
them.
Anything you might sense about any of them?
Yeah, I mean, when I in my my book UFOs, I describe a little bit about these special access programs that are abbreviated SAPs, and some of them are called unacknowledged special access programs, where they don't even you can't even get anybody who knows to even acknowledge that they exist, and they don't even have oversight. At least it appears to be the case. I mean, we're not even in a position to know whether they have oversight or not. But there has been a lot of work done on how these programs manage to escape detection, and one of the ways is that they will stash their goods in private industry. And that means that if somebody writes a Freedom of Information Act request, they can't get anything because the program isn't even in the government. So that's a way of keeping it even more secret and more buried. So I have run up against people who are aware of these programs. They have never been read into them, so they don't know exactly what's inside of them, but they have good ideas because they're insiders that some of these programs might contain physical materials or, you know, very, very sensitive documents about various events or whatever. But it is really, really, really impossible as a journalist to get that kind of information because it's so highly classified. It's just very and well hidden, both. And but, people who have the classification and the clearances to know this and to be part of this are never going to risk talking about it, or they'll be in big trouble.
Yeah, well, this is another thing that happens. There are all these people out there who are claiming to be whistleblowers. Tell us what you think about that whole process.
I don't know. I mean, the problem with a lot of the whistleblowers, because I sort of, you know, in my earlier years as a journalist, I paid a lot of attention to people like that, you know, deathbed confessions and things like that, or whistleblowers. And it seems like usually the ones to do with UFOs are, they're people with a story, and it's a very interesting story, and it could very well be true. But as a journalist, it doesn't help me very much unless they have some kind of documentation for it or unless they have other sources that can back up what they're saying. So I can't just take the story of one person and you know, as a journalist and expect that to go into a credible news source. It's just not enough. So that's the problem. I respect the stories that people tell, but I have no way of working them into my own work as a journalist in terms of what I can bring forward.
Because
You understand what I'm saying, right?
Oh, yeah. Because the actual narrative is secret. We don't know what is going on under the screen of secrecy. And if there are aliens here, they agree with the secrecy, or they are somehow or another being prevented from directly contacting us. One of the two. In a public way, because frankly, in a private way, they aren't impeded at all. So my assumption is they agree with the secrecy, and I outline my reasons for believing that in A New World. But in any case, this means that whoever's behind the scenes can control the public narrative on a whole lot of different levels. Like, for example, if you open up the books that Peter Lavenda wrote for Tom DeLonge, or they allegedly wrote together, but I have a feeling that's not how it worked. They're full of a narrative of evil reptilian aliens and all kinds of biblical references and stuff that seem completely fictional. And yet, Tom DeLonge went on the Joe Rogan show, which is a huge show that won't have me because I'm too weird. I mean, what
you're less
what
weird
are,
than Tom DeLonge.
What?
You're less weird than Tom DeLonge in a lot of ways.
In a lot of ways, yeah. The thing, ironically, I have got probably the strangest story ever told is the story of my life. And yes. Yet at the same time, I'm this terribly down-to-earth square. I mean, there's no other way to describe me. And so anyway, someone from behind the scenes can control the narrative, and they want to make the public narrative a narrative of strange, evil beings that are aliens and who have a malignant interest in us, but never seem to actually do anything. In other words, if there are evil reptilians here doing terrible things to people, where are they?
Right.
And yet I found a terrifying, and it's also in my book, terrifying material about things that have happened to people that are similar to cattle mutilations. And you are trying to make sense of all of this at another level. You're trying to make sense of the hardware UFO part of it. But how does the dark side of it affect you in your research especially?
Well, to be really honest, Whitley, I have to say that I just don't focus on it that much. And maybe that's not responsible on my part, but I only have so much time and energy, and it takes so much work for me to try to do stories for the New York Times and to try to stay on top of that level of things that stuff kind of lurks in the background for me. But I find cattle mutilations to be utterly fascinating, just really mysterious, really creepy. I think that's something extremely evidential of obviously some kind of negative force that's happening there, but I really haven't spent a lot of time on it. I think, you know a lot more than I do about it.
Or is it negative? Let me ask you this.
I don't know.
I mean, we
negative from our perspective, right?
Well, it looks ugly, but then again, go to a slaughterhouse. You want ugly, you got ugly there too. My
exactly.
point being that if there is somebody here who needs to use, who is not a vegetarian, they got to eat meat, they apparently chose to use the same food animal that we do.
That's a good point.
Yeah.
And then they put back whatever they're not going to use.
Right.
Much to our horror, for some reason, they want to use the rectum and the tongue or whatever these weird parts are. And not the rest of it.
Yeah, it's probably not going to be a very appetizing meal to us, but presumably it works for them.
I just don't understand it, Whitley. I mean, there's so many mysteries on this planet.
Oh,
this world
boy.
That, you know,
it's
and that's
loaded
one of them.
With them, isn't it?
It's loaded with them, and that one has always been one that I find fascinating. But, I question, too, with the whole scenario that Lavinda and TTSA is presenting, I mean, whether that really comes from some kind of secret entity that's trying to create a narrative or whether that just comes from those people, I don't know. I'm not going to assume it comes from anything bigger than their own perceptions and their own minds.
No, you can't
tell. Unless I have evidence for that. Yeah.
And, they're right. They're doing something that they're hoping will sell, I guess. And
it's entertainment.
Right.
A lot of it.
And yet, Lavinda was a very serious guy for a long time. He wrote one of the definitive works on the sort of hidden conspiratorial deep state level of the United States called Sinister Forces, a two-volume extraordinary work of journalism. Mm-hmm. Free Dreamlanders, we've come to the end of our time together. Subscribers, we're going to keep on keeping on. We are going to be talking now about that that May 2020 New York Times story about the Navy pilots flying over the Atlantic, and suddenly they begin to file hazard reports about unknown objects. Leslie is, I know, because we talked about it before the show. I'm not a mind reader. I don't think. I hope not. although that's a whole other thing. I don't want to get
I think in. You might be, Whitley.
I don't want to go down any of those paths. In any case, here we are, and we're going to be talking about the hazard reports and what you think may be actually going on there and what the Navy and others may be doing down the road and what you may be doing down the road, because this is not an inactive investigation after all, and you are a reporter. You must be able to leak a few things to us, hopefully. And Free Dreamlanders, thank you so much for being with us. Subscribers, we'll keep on keeping on. Leslie's website is Leslie Keen, or rather survivingdeathkane.com. Her books are Surviving Death and UFOs, Generals, Pilots, and Government Officials Go on the Record.
You've been listening to Dreamland. Be sure to tune in again next week. Dreamland is brought to you by UnknownCountry.com and its family of subscribers. Unknown Country was founded by Ann Streber. Our news editor is Matthew Frizzell. Our coordinator is Amy Safrankova. Whitley Streber is your Dreamland host, and I'm your announcer, Ted Alexander. Thank you for listening.